Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, Election Day, the 9th of August. And while this is on my mind, let me just say this. On Saturday of this week, we're having a reunion of the people who went to Washington on our trip, that marvelous trip. And I've tried to be in touch with all of you about where it is, when it is. If I missed any of you, I figure somebody's listening today and you'll spread the word. Please give me a call when I get off the air, and if you haven't heard about it, we're going to have a great time. So it's this Saturday, and call me or shoot me an email. My email is dunnk@wpr.org. That just came to mind because I was looking for some fun, as maybe some of you are now with all of the news of what's happening to money the last few days, and that is the focus of conversation, the first hour of our program today. What has happened to the nation's economy the first few days? As you know, the first day of trading after Standard & Poor's downgraded U.S. credit, Dow Jones Industrial Average closed yesterday down 634 points, 5.6%, the largest fall since December of 2008, the sixth worst total point drop in the history of the Dow Jones. Europe is not doing very well, and of course we've had this debt ceiling debate in this country for a long period of time. So here to make sense of the entire world economy this hour is Bob Landis. And Bob has been with us before. He's president of Landis & Company Investments, based here in Milwaukee. He has a huge client base all over the place. You may recall, those of you who live in Milwaukee, that he was on a radio station, another radio station, on a weekly call-in program. And he also did television for nearly 10 years, co-host of the nationally distributed public television show Dollar Signs. And he is with us to talk about the economy. He's a graduate of Millikan University, where he majored in economics, political science, and philosophy. Also studied economics at the University of Vienna in Austria. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I have a feeling we're going to be flooded with them this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Bob. Thanks so much for coming in and explaining everything that's going on.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Yeah, nice to have you here. I did have, as I was telling you off the air, a couple people say to me yesterday, wow, I just lost $50,000 of my retirement fund. I feel like I'm going to have to work forever. People are feeling this very personally. Is that going to have that kind of effect, all that's happened with the stock market, that 401ks, people lost a ton of money again, and they're worried that they're going to need to work another 10 years?
Well, Kathleen, it's certainly understandable for people to feel disenchanted, to imagine the futility out there with stocks now down 10% for the year. Just 3 weeks ago, we were up 6% for the year, had a halfway decent year going.
Just 3 weeks ago, really?
Yeah, we're down 16% in just a little over 2 weeks now. When you look at the markets, I think it's critically important to focus on fundamentals, because there are only two things that drive stock prices: interest rates and earnings. And the big disconnect that's occurring right now in the United States is that what's clearly driving corporate profits is growth overseas. Kathleen, consider that 40% of the world is growing in excess of 7% a year right now. 40% of the world, Brazil, India, and China. So 40% of the world's population is experiencing growth 3 to 4 times faster than what we experience here in the United States.
Nice.
So the problem we have is that the 500 biggest companies in the United States are about to set record levels of profit, the most profitable they've ever been in the history of the world. And yet we have 16 million people that have lost their work over the last 3 years. We've only created 1,750,000 jobs since a year ago, March, when the job creation initially occurred. And the point specifically is, if you're U.S.-centric in your view, you really don't get what's going on. The big global national, international corporations, they don't really care if they made a sale in Indiana or in India. It's a sale. But the problem is that globalization is not apt to increase jobs here in the United States. It's not likely to increase the price of your house. It's not likely to have a dramatic impact on the households here. It will definitely benefit the global corporations, as it already has. I mean, consider that the 500 biggest companies in the United States are now sitting on almost $1 trillion of cash, $963 billion. Now, that's up 58% since the financial crisis started 3 years ago. So companies are sitting on mountains of cash. They're in a much better financial shape than they were when the financial crisis started 3 years ago. So the disconnect, obviously, is, hey, Bob, hold it. We've got 17 million people that are either underemployed or unemployed. Everybody knows somebody that is in financial trouble. Everybody knows somebody that is struggling with employment or struggling to sell a house or buy a house. And yet here I am telling you that the 500 biggest companies in the United States are hitting record levels of profit this summer. So you have all that as a backdrop, and I think people were, regardless of your political affiliation, disenchanted with the manner in which the debt ceiling debate, yes, was conducted. So many of us are almost fed up with Washington. As you know, the approval ratings for Congress down to 14%. I mean, that's borderline pathetic. And there appears to be this unwillingness to compromise. And anybody that's ever been a legislator knows that you have to compromise to be able to make progress. Now, you're entitled to stand on your principles, but the essence is to work with your principles and try to reach some compromise, and that clearly didn't occur in Washington. And then furthermore, you have the problems in Europe. Frankly, I think that the S&P downgrade of U.S. Treasury debt was a non-event. Professional circles, because many of us knew that it was coming months ago.
Did you?
So the fact that, S&P announced late in the spring that if there wasn't meaningful debt reduction and or revenue increases, that they would downgrade the debt. So when it did occur, it wasn't that much of a newsflash, but I think that came really at a time of a perfect storm with the unsustainable structural issues in Europe. European debt is a mess compared to that of the United States. And I think that many investors were concerned that the fiscal austerity is coming at the worst time. This idea of cutting potentially $1 trillion of government spending, not only here but overseas, comes at a time when the economy is very fragile. So for many investment professionals, they see the reductions in spending. It's absolutely necessary, but the timing is pretty bad relative to how fragile the economy is. And then finally, what we saw late last month and early this month was manufacturing numbers, Institute of Supply Management manufacturing numbers, were much softer than expected, and consumer spending has slowed significantly. And then everybody's worst fear is this, in fact, a synchronized global slowdown? Are we all going down at once? What pulled us out of the financial crisis, Kathleen, as you know, was the emerging markets. It was the first recovery in U.S. history led by the emerging markets. We never had another recovery like it. And it's because Brazil, India, and China is growing faster than 7% a year. Most other recoveries in the United States were led by pent-up consumer demand. Gee, honey, let's wait to buy a house until the economy gets better. Let's wait to buy a car until things improve. And then when things improve, we all start buying, many of us buy cars and houses, and that,
right,
we surge from that trough. Well, that didn't have anything to do with this last recovery. It was caused because of the growth in primarily India, Brazil, and China, growing faster than 7% a year, as I said. And that's what pulled us out of the slump. So the point specifically is, if China starts slowing and India starts slowing and Brazil starts slowing, who's going to provide the leadership? What's going to provide the future growth? Well, fortunately, they're growing so fast. My guess is that we're going to do just fine longer term. But short term, there are plenty of worries on the radar screen, and therein lies the point of the decline in stock prices.
Well, go back to those corporations, because that's an astounding figure you gave us, the amount of money that they're just sitting on. Why are they sitting on that, and what difference would it make if they loosened up some of that money and jobs were created?
All right, so let me give you my economic answer, and then I'll give you the practical answer. Economists talk about capacity utilization, and in English that means how much of our plant and equipment in the United States are we currently using. And it's about 76% of all factories, machinery, plant and equipment is currently being utilized. So the point is that 24%, give or take, of plant and equipment is sitting idle. So if you run a factory, you're not real tempted to build a new plant if half of your plant or a quarter of your plant is sitting empty. You're less likely to buy new machinery. Now, ultimately, your machinery is going to become obsolete, and you're going to be forced to become more competitive and upgrade your machinery and your plant and equipment. But short term, there's little reason for you to upgrade if you have plenty of space. The practical point is that many people that run businesses wait until they're just drop dead positive the business is improving before they hire, before they expand. A third point would be that a lot of people had the fear of God put in them during the financial crisis and started stockpiling cash. The average U.S. consumer has increased their savings rate dramatically. Prior to the downturn, we had a negative savings rate in the United States. People thought, my house is going up in value. My 401k is going up. I don't really need to save a whole lot. Well, not no more, as they say. And as a result, the savings rate for consumers has gone up. It's about 6% right now of personal income. And the companies in the country have that same motivation to stockpile cash during uncertain times. And there aren't a lot of places to deploy cash if you run a business. If you're not interested in increasing your capacity or expanding your operation, we've seen an increase in mergers and acquisitions up till this last month. My guess is that'll slow down because of current events. But we've seen more and more companies acquire businesses for that cash. But it's very refreshing, I think, and frankly reassuring to see that corporate America, the non-financial S&P companies sitting on almost $1 trillion of cash, that will help them weather whatever storm is going to come our way.
Mm. The president yesterday spoke during the middle of this, trying to calm everybody down, and the stock market still fell quite a bit. Can you tell us, because we're having this political battle that's going on, the whole idea of how we're going to deal with this debt came to spending cuts. And it seemed as though many people thought that the president kind of caved on this and has not been a strong leader when calling for another part of the equation, which is to make sure there's more revenue coming in, thus perhaps creating jobs. The New York Times editorial, a lot of economists are saying you've got to create jobs in this country as part of the equation. Do we need presidential leadership, and does the leadership need to take the form of a really big jobs program and an increase in taxes on those who have more in this country to make this crisis less of a crisis?
Kathleen, frankly, I run a $2 billion firm, and frankly, I wonder what Washington would be able to provide me as an incentive to hire more people. I focus on my company's fundamentals. I look at our revenue. I look at our balance sheet. I look at our expenses and a host of other considerations before I decide to expand the firm. And, I'm not saying they can't do anything, but, for most of us that run companies, we aren't that dependent on government handouts at all, and we're not focused on what little trick can they do to provide growth and employment. And, I guess my point is that there are two things that I try to focus on as a money manager: earnings and interest rates. And oftentimes I look at what happens in Washington as somewhat as a theatrical event. When you look at the debt crisis, Kathleen, I think it's really important to remember that over the last 3 years, the biggest percentage increase in our debt was caused by a collapse in tax receipts, right? It wasn't new spending. 36% of the increase in our deficit was caused by all the millions of people that lost their employment, and they're not paying income tax anymore. And for investors, they weren't paying as much in capital gains. Corporations weren't paying as much in income tax. The second biggest reason for the increase in the deficit was the extension of the Bush tax cuts. So most economists know that. 20% of the increase was caused by the extension of the Bush tax cuts. Less than 10% of the deficit was caused by new spending. And if you think we're going to declare two wars every decade and have a financial crisis every decade, then you bet we're in a lot of trouble. But most economists know that during periods like the after 9/11, that it, whether you were for the war or against it, there are times when you want to defend our national interest, and it's important to do such. And as a result, if you have to borrow money to facilitate that, then so be it. And the same thing applies to the financial bailouts. Most of us that try to stay neutral on this issue look at TARP as an ugly, necessary thing. And it worked. Looking at GM's bailout, it worked. Mm-hmm. Pretty ugly. Nobody liked all the details, but it worked. And the specific point is we swelled the deficit because of fighting two wars and because of the financial bailouts. And then ultimately what gilded the lily, if you will, is the collapse in tax receipts because of the downturn. So the reason why I'm telling you all this, that of course, is that, we put ourselves in a situation that was clearly unsustainable, but Wall Street didn't react negatively because most of the people that try to stay neutral on the issue realized that these were, for the most part, temporary events. To the extent that we keep our nose out of trouble and don't keep picking wars, picking fights, the point is that military spending should subside, financial bailouts are subsiding, we ultimately create jobs. And I think that's the specific point, Kathleen. If you want to bring the deficits down, create employment, create jobs, get people paying income tax, because that's the way you want to reduce the deficits. And just cutting spending, I'm concerned about that because it comes at a time when we're fairly fragile. As you know, the government revised downward the growth estimates for this year down to just 0.8%. Many thought that we were going to grow at 4% this year. We're going to be lucky to do 2% and perhaps even less than that. So you want to create employment. You want to bring down the deficit.
We have all our phone lines going, and we'll take your phone calls in just a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Bob Landis is our guest this hour, president of Landis & Company Investments, based here in downtown Milwaukee. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program, Christian Parenti will be with us. His latest book is Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. He has spent the past 6 years going to countries where not only is there political upheaval, but climate change has really hit these countries hard. Places in Africa, Mexico, Afghanistan, and he paints an alarming picture of what will happen to the world, actually, as a result of increased levels of global warming in places that are having problems politically. It's a really good book. So that's our number two. Let's start with an email from Peter in Shawano. Please discuss why the world economy is paying such attention to these same rating companies that rated the toxic junk so high ahead of the economic collapse 3 years ago.
I think Standard & Poor's embarrassed themselves during the financial crisis and are partly responsible for the crisis by rating many subprime mortgages AAA, and investors depended upon those AAA ratings to make investment decisions, only to find that they weren't AAA paper. And when S&P comes out and suggests that and says that they're going to downgrade U.S. Treasury debt, let me put it to you another way. Many of the large money management firms that I work with in the United States don't even use S&P ratings. The biggest bond management firm in the world sent me an email late Sunday night and talked about how they don't even look at S&P ratings, and they haven't for years. Consider if when you have a bond underwriting, you have to pay S&P for the rating. and you pay hundreds of thousands, oftentimes millions of dollars for the rating, and then you're going to quit paying if you don't get a favorable rating. You know, I heard the expression the other morning, if the New York Times got paid $500,000 for every favorable article, never got paid a nickel for unfavorable articles, you would expect to read a lot of favorable articles in the paper. So I think they've almost become irrelevant. Please note that Moody's, which is much larger than S&P, did not downgrade U.S. debt, nor did Fitch's. I think it does matter on the periphery, but there's just nothing safer than U.S. debt. And for S&P to downgrade, you know, I think they're struggling with their image. I think they're struggling with their reputation because they just blew it badly during the financial crisis. And I don't have much respect for them, nor do I pay a lot of attention to their ratings.
Was the market responding, though, to that rating on Friday, yesterday?
Well, the announcement came Friday after the market closed, so people had over the weekend to stew about it. And there were a number of ramifications. As you saw in the paper this morning, even Northwestern Mutual Life got downgraded yesterday because they're holding government paper, which is now just AA+, not AAA, and a lot of pension funds. We've seen some selling in the end of the municipal market where the debt is backed by government bonds that have now been downgraded. So you, of course, have to downgrade that debt. And then I think just the perfect storm of the uncertainty surrounding the debt ceiling, the structural problems in Europe that are not easily solved, coming at a time when the economy is clearly slowing down, not only in the United States and Europe, but in the Far East. And I think the downgrade of the S&P debt was the spark that ignited the very dry tinder and provided the reason for the sell-off. And then technically, Kathleen, you saw a lot of margin selling yesterday. So if you borrow a lot of money to buy stock, and in the United States, you can margin your account more than 50%. So if the stock values decline, you either have to come up with cash or the investment firm is going to sell out your positions. So there was a fair amount of forced selling yesterday. And I think that's an important point for investors. When you see a liquidity squeeze on the street, don't get squeezed unless you have to. Don't even contemplate selling your life savings at a big discount unless you truly need the money in a very short period of time. And if that's the case, you probably shouldn't have been in the market at all with that money. But when the pros look at liquidity squeeze, you know, they tend to sell what they can get rid of quickly, and that drove the market. And it's interesting to see that stocks are up a couple hundred points as of right now. And pretty hard to take much into that because the market's been so volatile. But my guess is once the margin selling dries up and the hedge fund selling dries up, we'll be close to the bottom. And it's the law of physics. What defines a market bottom is when you've exhausted all sellers. The selling pressure tends to intensify as prices decline. But at some point, you get the capitulation phase that anybody that was going to sell sold, and the markets have nowhere to go but up.
We go to Marie in Bayview. Hi, Marie. Oh, Marie, you're not there. Habu in Madison. Hi.
Hello, and good morning. It seems very ironic that finally market discipline is coming to the U.S. of A. So often in the past, the United States administrations would tell nations that were struggling economically, like the Soviet Union, the Asian crisis in late 90s, that they had to make their economies more market-friendly. And finally, it seems like this is coming home. The United States has to face the discipline from the market, as it were. But what is really ironic is that that S&P is considered part of the market, when in fact, it, as had been said earlier, it had been paid to give these false ratings for these credit default swaps, etc. So this is all rather bemusing. Thank you.
Bob.
Well, I agree with everything you said. You know, remember back in 1999 that we actually had a balanced budget in the United States, that we had a surplus, in fact. Didn't last but a year and a half. But it wasn't all that long ago that we had a balanced budget. And then year and a half later, 9/11 comes along, and I explain the rest of the story. So short term, there are reasons why you want to borrow. It wouldn't be any different than if your family experienced dramatic medical problems. You had to borrow money for an operation or a procedure. The same thing applies in running our government. And I think the gentleman's comment of what we insisted on after the Russian financial crisis, after the long-term capital management problem in the second half of the 90s, the Asian financial crisis in 98, that we insisted around the world that countries get their collective act together as a requisite for the aid that they received. So it's interesting to see that it's finally coming back to roost now, that investors are insisting that the U.S. government get their act together. And perhaps it's a wonderful wake-up call to the politicians in Washington investors just want to get something done, and they're interested in compromise. And, let's get the thing done so we can get on with it.
Roseanne in Milwaukee. Hi, Roseanne.
Hi. I have a question, two-part question, actually. I know the Republicans are resistant to any tax increases, and they certainly don't want more spending. But in the last big depression, the Civilian Conservation Corps, which was the government as an employer, put people to work, which then gave them money to spend. Wouldn't that, in combination with getting rid of some of these big tax subsidies to big oil and big agribusiness, and maybe increasing the tax rate for the very wealthy, wouldn't that combination help considerably and get our economy back on target?
Yes. Roseanne, the specific point is most of the mainstream economists that I respect have acknowledged that a combination of reductions in spending and increases in revenue will be least harmful for the economy. Most mainstream economists look at just getting the deficit down by spending cuts will have cause greater harm to economic activity than a combination of spending cuts and revenue increases. But you have a whole lot of people that got elected to Congress that refused to budge, that have told people that, you know what, you can have it all. You can have your Medicaid, you can have your Medicare, you can have your tax deductions, you can have everything you want, and we're even going to lower your taxes. I think that's fantasy land, and that's partially how we got into this trouble. And it's interesting to see that, 11 years ago, we actually had a balanced budget, budget here in the United States, and, it only took 11 years to create the problem. So, Roseanne, I'm not a politician. I'm a money manager. But I think your point's right on the money, that some combination of spending cuts and revenue increases is ultimately necessary. And my guess is when the bipartisan commission comes down, that's what they're going to ultimately agree upon.
Really? You think that will happen?
Well, look at the deal that John Boehner ultimately passed up 3 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. It wasn't quite tax increases. It was reducing and almost eliminating the ethanol subsidies and other types of subsidies. Frankly, that's a revenue increase, no matter what you call it. Ultimately, I think we're going to be forced to get everybody to the table and to reach some kind of compromise where you can't just draw the line in the sand. And I think both parties are going to have to give in to get the country to where we need to go.
But he couldn't get it through. Eric Cantor had to take hold of the ship.
Yeah, Kathleen, I think people are going to look back and say that they really should have taken that deal, that was the best on the table at the time. And, plenty of people are suggesting that. But be that as it may, the point specifically is that when you look going forward at how best to tackle the problems, many of us that manage money, we don't particularly care how you get there, just get there. And hopefully because of the downturn now, be a wake-up call for the folks in Washington.
Thanks, Roseanne, for the call. We go to Charles in Ingleside, Illinois. Hi, Charles.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, Charles.
Earlier in the show, you said that the American corporations are in a very good position. I wonder, I've heard that American corporations are taxed more than any other in the world. And then I've heard that they've been taxed less than any other in the world. What is, what's the story there?
Charles, when you look at the 500 largest corporations in the United States, almost all of them are global in nature, and they do business in many cases in 100 or more countries around the globe. And as a result, you know, they're able to whittle away at their tax liabilities by moving money around the planet. And as such, you see many of the largest corporations in the United States pay very little, if any, corporate income tax. So the tax rates may be fairly high, but that's very different than what corporations actually pay. You know, as a money manager, I focus on earnings. I look at the corporate profits. They're supposed to go up 18% this year. The record for corporate profits was set in September of 07. If you look at earnings per share, 500 stocks in the S&P, excluding negatives, we hit a record of $89.87 in September of 07. And the analysts think that we'll hit $99.75 by year end. That's clearly a record for profits. And moreover, Charles, if you look at next year, you know, the analysts are still anticipating a 14% increase in profits next year and an 11% increase in 2013. Now, herein lies the point for those stock investors that are listening. In a normal year, if earnings go up 18%, stock prices will go up 18% as long as interest rates don't take off on us. Interest rates and earnings are what cause stocks to go up and down. So the way I do math, if the PE on the market right now is just 13, historically it's averaged almost 16, so the fundamentals are attractive, and if earnings go up 18% this year, anywhere near 14% next year, let alone the 11% that they're forecasting the year after next, stocks are going to do pretty well. Because it's all about what are you willing to pay for a dollar of earnings. And historically, investors are willing to pay $16 for a dollar of earnings. Right now, they're only paying $13 for a dollar of earnings. But if those earnings are supposed to go up 18%, then 14%, then 11%, you can see a pretty good stock price increase moving forward. But short term, we've got all of these storms that have to pass, and the sky's got to clear before investors get back to fundamentals.
Thanks very much for the call. I'm still wondering, the more we talk here, about what it's going to take to break this logjam. You'll have this bipartisan commission. They'll come up with what you just suggested. You still got this incredible rancor in Congress, incredible partisanship on these issues. It's hard for me to understand who's going to say, this is what has to be done. We'll get the confidence of the American people, and we'll get people to budge from their position on this issue.
Well,
I don't see that happening.
Well, here's one idea. Could come from China.
Really?
The Chinese government called Hank Paulson in September of 08 and insisted that the government take over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. If I held over $1 trillion of government debt, you bet I'd be making phone calls to the Treasury Department to insist that changes get made.
Hmm.
The economic theory is monetization, that ultimately the people that hold our debt could dictate the terms. You know, right now that's not happening. So there's one idea. Secondly, I think as more and more Americans spend time trying to understand the debt issues, they will ultimately start electing representatives that will do something about it. You know, think back 8 years ago, Bush administration was making comments, specifically Dick Cheney, that deficits don't matter anymore. So, you know, you guys can't have it both ways. You either say it matters or it doesn't matter and stick to that storyline. But ultimately, I think that we'll get some relief because of the bipartisan commission. And frankly, Kathleen, what the president and Congress did agree upon is a step in the right direction. You know, no one got what they wanted, but it is, for all intents and purposes, a step forward. And obviously we'll need more steps like that to be able to tackle the problem.
Let's go next to Willem in Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I was thinking that, you know, what's going on with this, the demand of the Congress to pass a balanced budget?
Wait, you need to speak up, Willem.
Oh, you know, the demand of the Tea Party people that we have a balanced budget amendment, and what our governor in Wisconsin said when he took office, that he dropped the bomb. I feel like all this uncertainty and all this fear and all this thing that's being created by these Tea Party people has put a real spell on our economy, that a large part of what drives an economy is the perception of the people who are in it. And everyone I talk to around here is sort of scared of the future. They don't know what's going to happen. You know, the people keep saying we can't tax the job creators, and this whole Reagan trickle-down theory that's never seemed to work. I just feel like that's in a large part responsible for what's going on top of the structural things, obviously, but there's this, all of a sudden the Tea Party people seem to have discovered that the credit economy, like they've never heard of that before, like families have a budget balanced, which, you know, credit card debt, all that sort of stuff. It's just ridiculous. I think these people are really driving this country to the edge.
Bob.
Well, on this specific point, I suppose, is to talk about the negative feedback loop. You know, economists look at the potential for a downward cycle, the uncertainty that you reference will causes people to postpone purchases, which causes the economy to slow further, which causes more people to postpone purchases, which reinforces the downward trend. And this is known as the negative feedback loop. And, you know, a lot of the pros out there will tell you that it's very real, it's measurable, and it's something that you want to worry about. In the investment world, we talk about animal spirits, the sense that if you believe that the world is going to be a better place tomorrow, you're more apt to take risk. And if you think it looks pitch black on the horizon, you're less likely to take risk. So it's all about your level of optimism. Willem, I'm a pretty optimistic guy by my nature. I think the world's going to be a better place day by day, year after year. But short-term, that negative feedback loop that I referenced is a very real problem. Now, I just wanted to quickly mention something that you said about the Tea Party folks. You know, there's part of what is being advanced by the Tea Party that I think is good, which is the sense that you need to live within your means. And I think that that message clearly has to get delivered to Washington, and I think they're doing that job and perhaps even the country a favor. You know, where I disagree, and I'm not a politician here or a political scientist, but I think it's the art of compromise that truly is at the heart of being a really good political leader. And if you're not willing to compromise, you're not able to lead. And that's why I think that they're going to need to change their tune.
Thanks very much for the call. We're talking about what's been happening on Wall Street, what's been happening with political gridlock, what's happening on a worldwide basis concerning the economy. Of course, our conversation prompted by yesterday's horrible day on Wall Street. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our guest is Bob Landis, president of Landis & Company Investments, based here in Milwaukee. And our email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Tuesday, Christian Parenti, author of, I think, a very important book, Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. Bob Landis is with us this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. I just want to ask you, the other thing that I heard from people yesterday is that they're looking, there's a big baby boom population in this country that's looking at retirement fairly soon. A lot of 401k money is in stock market, and they look at the drop yesterday and translate it immediately to, oh, I lost $40,000, I lost $10,000, I lost a lot of my retirement money. I'm sure you are hearing from those people as well. Bob, what do you say to them?
Kathleen, when you look at wealth in the United States, it's very unequal. The New York Times did a study about a month and a half ago, maybe 2 months ago. They now estimate that half of the country either can't or probably can't come up with $2,000 within 30 days.
Unbelievable.
I mean, think of that.
Wow.
Half the country. Moreover, pending retirements, the average American, 60 to 64, has less than $150,000 saved for retirement. So the way I do math, that tells you, all right, that'll last 4 or 5 years. For much of the 90s, we spent time in the media scolding people hey, you better get going. You better start saving money. The sooner you start saving, the better it's going to be. And now the studies are showing that, frankly, it's too late for a lot of people. That the idea of retiring out of pocket full of money and spending your declining years at leisure is becoming more and more of a myth for more people. The percentage of folks working past age 65 is climbing dramatically in the United States. And, you know, most people just didn't get the arithmetic of, you know, you got to save a little bit of money every month, year after year, decade after decade. If your company's not going to provide a fixed pension, then you better take care of it yourself. You know, you think about wealth in the United States, a lot of people have it wrong. $1 million is rare anymore. Less than 3% of the American households have $1 million of financial assets. And the 3%. And, you know, even $1 million is only going to give you $50,000, $60,000 a year in income. So the vast majority of boomers are not at all prepared for retirement. And the study showed that, and the survey showed that, more and more folks just plan on working well into their 60s and perhaps even longer to take care of their financial needs.
So they took it on the chin in the 2008 drop, and a lot of people lost a great deal of their retirement accounts. Do you think that we're seeing that again, Bob, or is that optimistic side of you saying it's going to get better?
So for investors that were properly balanced and have half their money in stocks and half their money in bonds as they should, they've recovered from the sell-off during the financial crisis. The world's a very different place than it was at the beginning of the financial crisis. Just consider U.S. banks. The big banks are in much better shape here in America than they were at the onset of the financial crisis. We already talked about corporate America. Their cash levels are up 58%, approaching almost $1 trillion, up dramatically since the financial crisis began. And as a result, I don't think we're going to repeat anywhere close to what we went through 3 years ago. When you look at the stock market, it's all about earnings. Earnings have to go up for stocks to go up. And because of the globalization that's occurring in the world and strong corporate profit growth in those areas like Brazil, India, and China really is fueling corporate profits here in the United States. And that ultimately drives stock prices. And I'm optimistic that we'll end the year in a positive way for the stock market. And once we get past the current storm, people will focus on interest rates and earnings and realize that the stock market's a bargain.
Reed in Clintonville. Hi, Reed.
Well, good morning, and also good morning to Willem from one potter to another. What I would like to address is the issue of the fact that there are so many folks out of work at this time that they are not contributing not only to the tax base, but also they're not contributing to their own welfare by way of, let's say, Social Security, which has been proposed as a privatized facility, and by the Republicans, mean-spirited that they are. And consequently, when these folks reach retirement age, if they can ever retire, their Social Security income will be minuscule. Thus putting a further burden on programs, social programs across the country, which will be by that time devastated or disemboweled practically by mean-spirited thugs on the right. And I guess basically that's what I'd like to hear a comment concerning.
All right. Thanks, Reed.
Reed, I think part of the point should be that we need to increase employment to make a meaningful reduction in the deficits long term. You know, and the problem is that you have people that are unemployable. Look at the city of Milwaukee as an example. 26% of the adults in the city of Milwaukee can't read or write at a third grade level. Okay? So that's a little over a quarter of the adults in this city are functionally illiterate. And 30 years ago, in Milwaukee, it was possible to make a middle-class income, own a house, send your kids to college, And it didn't matter if you couldn't read or write. Well, those jobs either were sent to the maquiladora operations in Mexico, or they were sent to Asia, or they were computerized. So those jobs are gone. And it's no longer possible for people that are functionally illiterate to find meaningful employment where they can take care of themselves and their family. So that's point number one. Point number two is, statistically, if you're out of work for more than 6 months, the likelihood of your finding employment declines. So what's so different about this period in the business cycle is that we have millions of people that have been out of work for way more than 6 months. And statistically, the numbers go way down. You get discouraged. You have all sorts of problems in finding employment. Reed, I think that the third point is that it's difficult for the government to stimulate jobs. And we, you know, expect Washington to solve all our problems. And, you know, as I said earlier in the program, running a $2 billion firm, I really don't look for to Washington for help. You know, we pick ourselves up by the bootstraps. We get hurt. We rub some dirt in it, just keep going. And, you know, we don't look for handouts or benefits. And, you know, when I see my business growing, I know that I'm able to hire more people to help me out. And that's what causes me to hire. And, you know, the point that I'm trying to get at here is sometimes I think we expect too much from the folks in Washington, and I'm not sure that the employment situation is easily solved because of the globalization issue. You know, look at where all the corporate profits, they're not coming from sales in the United States. They're coming from outside the United States, and that certainly benefits employment for the global firms. But if your job's tied to housing or you sell carpet, tile, appliances, you're either dead or dying because of the nature of the beast of housing. Reed, I think it's ultimately about creating jobs. I'm not quite sure how to do it, but I know that if you want to make a meaningful reduction in the deficit, you better figure out how to create employment.
That is a knockout figure, you said. I had not heard this before. 26% of adults are functionally illiterate in Milwaukee?
This is according to Literacy Services.
Wow. Oh, that stops me in my tracks.
Can't read or write at a third grade level.
Wow. Here's something along the lines of what you were just saying. If I can find it. I don't think that the state of the world's economy should come as a surprise to anybody who's taken a basic economics course. Businesses want cheap labor. America has a high standard of living. Labor rates are high. The emerging economies of Brazil, India, and China have lower standards of living and cheaper labor. So, of course, American businesses outsource. I don't think there's anything aside from high importing taxes that can get these lost production jobs to move back to the United States.
Well, trade wars are partially what caused the Great Depression in the 1930s, and most economists are very fearful of import fees, tariffs, what have you. You know, the hard part about capitalism is that it can be brutal, but you want to allow companies to sell anywhere on the planet. And that means you're going to have competition, and competition is a good thing because it makes people run faster, jump higher, work smarter, work longer to compete. Competition is a good thing, not a bad thing for capitalism. And the coolest thing about capitalism, in my opinion, is the concept of creative destruction. This idea of if you allow money to move freely around the world, that investors will gang up on companies that have high rates of return, high margins, they'll reduce the margins because of competition, and then money will find a better place. Frankly, one of the problems with China is they don't have free rein on their capital, and it's state organized. And ultimately, what will cause America to get out of our current slump is that we have this willingness, if you will, in a wonderful blend of capitalism and democracy that allows money to move freely. So, Reed, the last thing you want is a tariff. You want to bring in competition. Have at it. Let people compete, but let businesses sell anywhere they want to. That's what's best for everybody.
Marie in Bayview, we have about a minute left, everybody. Hi, Marie.
Hi there. I think that, as FDR did in the 30s, government can create jobs. I don't mean that government should hire more people. I mean that we have a huge infrastructure deficit. And this is the time we have and need to change that. And, okay, the Tea Party doesn't like borrowing money, but I don't think there's anything the matter with borrowing money at 2.5%, a couple of trillion, to fix the country. This will have a multiplier effect.
All right, I need to hold you on that thought. We're almost out of time, Marie. Bob?
Yeah, I agree. I think fiscal austerity is coming at the worst time. The economy is too fragile. We should be looking at other forms of stimulus like job creation to get the economy back on its feet.
All right. Well, that was, you did that in less than the amount of time you had allotted to you. So, Bob, are you optimistic?
I am. I'm guardedly optimistic.
Right.
I think the selling perhaps could continue for another couple of weeks, but ultimately investors, the smart ones, will focus on the fundamentals of earnings and interest rates and realize that the stock market's a bargain.
Okay. Thank you, Bob, so much.
Thanks for having
me. Bob Landis, president of Landis & Company Investments, based here in Milwaukee. You probably are aware of Bob because he was, for many years, some 20 years, did a talk show on another radio station we won't name. We both worked there, actually, at some time. He did his own weekly call-in program and then did 10 years as co-host of the public television show Dollar Signs. We thank him for being with us. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production. Thanks to Chrissy for producing the program as well. And thanks for all of your calls, everybody. Stay tuned for the next hour. It is an absolutely fascinating book. It's very, got a lot of layers to it and some incredibly important information. So stay tuned for that. And news will be coming up shortly as well on the Ideas Network.